books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and this week the show is being recorded on location at Dumfries House in Ayrshire at the Boswell Book Festival. And today I chat to a comedian, a Hollywood icon and a Buddhist monk, plus find some new biographies in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Coming up in today's edition of Read On, recorded at the Boswell Book Festival, star of stage and screen, Rupert Everett, will give us an American no. Meditation teacher, author and Buddhist monk, Geelong Thubten will tell us about A Monk's Guide to Happiness and his handbook for hard times. And up first, comedian Helen Lederer will give us the lowdown on her memoir, Not That I'm Bitter. All that coming up on today's Read On. What was it like as one of a handful of women at the heart of the Write On alternative comedy scene in the 1980s? Piece of cake? Bit of a laugh? Well, yes and no. It had its ups, but also its downs. Helen Lederer was a regular on the stand-up circuit and new wave sketch shows in the decade that launched the careers of today's comedy household names and national treasures. She shared stages with pioneers like Ben Elton and John Hegley, and TV screens with Don French, Jennifer Saunders, Harry Enfield, and many others. From the iconic Absolutely Fabulous to Bottom, Happy Families, Naked Video, French and Saunders, and Girls on Top, it's difficult to think of a comedy show of that era that Helen wasn't a part of. So, plain sailing then? Well, not really. Not That I'm Bitter. Her powerful, frank, moving and characteristically funny memoir reveals exactly how choppy those waters could be. Even in those groundbreaking anti-Thatcher days, there was only room at the top for so many women. For the rest, it was as much a struggle to be seen and heard in the world of comedy as in any boardroom or workplace, and just as difficult to avoid the predators. This is not just a memoir about that decade, though. It's a genuinely funny memoir with lots of heart and just the right amount of bitterness. Helen Lederer pulls no punches, but every blow is wrapped in a laugh of recognition. Helen was at the book festival with the new updated version of Not That I'm Bitter, two brand new chapters in print and in audio, as read by Helen Lederer.
I'm standing on a diving board with my arms in the air, looking at a red light. A producer is lurking hundreds of feet below me, looking worried. She calls up. You're not showing enough. I hiss back. It's been agreed. No camel toe. But the producer wants more. Do not dive until the red light goes out, she says, adding, and look scared, but in a funny sort of way. A few weeks before, I'd been shopping for Christmas gifts when my agent rang. I've been asked if you want to do a reality TV show. I put my bath bombs back on the counter. Someone wanted me for a job. This felt pleasant. The agent was still speaking. And they want you to dive. This less so. Dive? Where? Water? I had no idea if I could dive. I didn't even know if I could jump into a pool. I'd got into the habit of lowering myself in via the steps in the shallow end to protect my highlights. Why? Because it's Splash, a new diving show with Tom Daley. Everyone has to dive. Can't I still be in it and not dive? No, they've already got Jo Brand. Why? What's she doing? Judging. Of course she was. And it was with a dull sort of sadness that I knew I would now have to dive in public for money. The red light goes out. I tip myself forward and make myself fall into nothingness. I am here with my memoir, paperback version, new, called Not That I'm Bitter, same title, but it's got two new chapters about when I went on the pilgrimage, which is out on BBC, and also a chapter about my lovely friend Tony Slattery about the funeral. I was trying to make light of it in a humorous way, so I think Tony would have been pleased with how I tackled it. I was 10 years old when I first discovered not everyone finds the same things funny. My mother was looking grim. I'd just started on my evening Nesquik when I was summoned downstairs. "I've just had Mrs. Finch on the phone." "Oh, yes." "She noticed some ink on Sarah's knickers this evening. Do you know anything about that?"
"Ink?"
"Yes, apparently somebody had used a biro."
"A biro?"
"Yes. There were a pair of eyes on her..." My mother paused. "Bottom, which Mrs. Finch said hadn't been there when she left this morning."
I said nothing.
"Mrs. Finch said she's rather concerned."
Until Mrs. Finch's concern, I was in a really good mood. We'd all had such a laugh, and now this.
"We were just doing a game where I was a surgeon," I began, "and I drew these eyes as part of the operation, and it was so funny, and..."
"I'll have to tell her you were showing off," sighed my mother, and went off to phone Mrs. Finch to apologise.
Now, the audio version, did you narrate that yourself?
Oh, yes. I wasn't going to let anyone else do it. Why would you do that? So, yeah, and I got the extra chapters done as well, recorded sort of 8 months later, so my voice might have aged somewhat. But, no, it's exciting being here at Boswell. It's very posh, but everyone is very nice.
The last time we spoke, you'd just finished doing Splash. What's the programme you've just finished doing now?
So the programme I've finished doing now is called The Pilgrimage. It's on BBC, and it's where you get apparently known individuals coming together to walk a pilgrimage path and to be encouraged to talk amongst themselves about faith or lapsed faith or lack of faith or connection to faith. So at least it was an opportunity to be other than when I was in the Big Brother house, which had a very different vibe about it.
I was 13 when I learnt there was a name for people of mixed heritage.
"What's a half-caste?" I asked my friend Francis.
Stephanie and I were reading the problem page in Petticoat magazine. We'd become curious about a published letter from someone calling herself a half-caste.
"We are," said Francis.
It felt good to be told I was part of an official club without having to do anything to earn it. What were the chances? Francis's father was half Nigerian-Italian and her mother was Scottish gentry.
"Really?"
asked Stephanie, sounding as pleased as me.
"Stephanie's half Gibraltar and you're half Czech. That's a half-caste," explained Francis. "And half Isle of Wight," I added, for extra lineage.
This may explain why we all got on, apart from our shared interest in shoplifting in Lewisham.
And what did you find out about yourself on the pilgrimage?
I found out that I was more emotional than I thought and more connected to my family's past. They called me mixed heritage, which was a careful description of someone like myself whose father came over to this country in 1939, cultural Jew, not a religious person. In fact, someone who didn't believe in God at all. But the history was there, and it sort of engendered a lot of thought that I hadn't done before. And I quite like buildings now of any faith where people get together. It's a bit like theatre. It's a bit like the gig I'm about to do, you know, where people are coming together with a common purpose. So it's quite exciting.
Where did the title of your book come from?
The title, not that I'm bitter, is an attempt at being ironic about being in the business this long, not being in the A-team, and sort of finding that absurdly amusing that one minds a bit. And I think a lot of people can relate to not being in the A-team because very few people are in the A-team.
Now, you narrated the audio version of the book. We are from RNIB Connect Radio, so now the book's accessible to people for whatever reason, be that sight loss, dyslexia, any, don't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Very important that people can just get into a listening situation. You get so much from the voice and, you know, and podcasts and things. People just, it's normal now, isn't it, to go on walks and you just connect. And the fact that the author is reading it is special, I think. But I love audio, what you can do with audio, the theatre of it. I was in an open prison recently and a lot of the people there listen to Radio 4 and the, you know, the afternoon plays. So there's a lot to be said for audio.
How do you, as someone who's used to acting on TV, pour that performance just down into the microphone.
It's lovely because it's completely uninterrupted by anything else, and you just kind of channel your brain into your voice, and there's no interruption. It's a very direct form of communication with the listener. My mother Jean met my father at a club in London where many Czech and Polish students gathered after the war. Her background was very different from his. We never heard her sing, unlike my father, who would break into song on long car journeys, which felt very open and free compared with other adults who lived in Eltham at that time. But she was always happy to tell us she was from the wrong side of the Isle of Wight, and bought shop-made pastry to prove it. And once, in the 70s, she purchased a bri nylon loose cover for an armchair, which is either impressively modern or irredeemably lower middle class. She left the island at 17 to go to university. Then she was recruited to Bletchley Park. She told us it was that or the Land Army, and there'd be more sitting down as a decoder. She was decoding and keeping secrets at the same time my Czech grandfather was eavesdropping on captured German generals at Trent Park in North London as a secret listener and reporting his findings to British intelligence. They didn't know about each other. Too secret. Then she got a job in the Board of Trade, which was where women went if they wanted interesting jobs that men did at the same time. I'm not sure what exactly she did at the Board of Trade, but negotiating deals with other countries and allocating resources to certain industries are likely areas of activity. Sadly, she didn't have very long to do it, because women in the 50s were expected to give up their careers once they got married.
Not that I'm bitter. A truly madly funny memoir, written and read by Helen Lederer, is available commercially. And Helen Lederer will be back at the end of the show with the books of my life.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
My love of reading is very great, and the pleasure I have derived from books is very great.
Author, actor and creator of Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes, on why he supports Talking Books.
I hate to think of people being cut off from that pleasure through no fault of their own. And it is very, very difficult to live without sight when you have been seeing. But the truth is that there is no reason for them to lose their pleasure in reading. If we can just create the talking books, you know, the nightmare that faces us is how few books become talking books. And we have to change that. You know, these books will last forever now under the new technology. It's not as if one's doing it and then they get read for a summer and thrown out. This is forever. This whole business of talking books matters to me. Reading is everything. You know, when you're blind, reading is travel. Reading is the last way that you can still enjoy certain things that are no longer realistic for a blind person to enjoy autonomously. It is an absolute lifeline, and we can help them keep that lifeline going.
For more information on the Talking Book service and how to support it, head to rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Now, in the spirit of the Boswell Book Festival, let's find some new biographies in the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems. Newly in the library is The True History of the Elephant Man, by Michael Howell and Peter Ford.
When the Elephant Man appeared as if from nowhere in a shop premises in the Whitechapel Road in London towards the end of November 1884, he was still in the early days of his career as a professional freak. His real name, as his birth certificate bears witness, was Joseph Carey Merrick, and his manager at that time was Mr. Tom Norman, a showman who specialised in the display of freaks and novelties. The shop hired for his exhibition was then numbered 123 Whitechapel Road. The building survives today as one in a terraced row of early 19th century shops, though it has since been renumbered as 259. The adjoining premises to its east side carried, until recently, the pawnbroker's emblem of three iron balls high up on the wall. To the west side lay the shop of Mr. Michael Geary, fruiterer and greengrocer. Directly across the road from the row of shops, on the other side of the wide thoroughfare, stands the imposing entrance to the London Hospital. The present front, in fact, dates from improvements made in 1891. In the 1880s, the hospital displayed a long and imposing classical façade, set well back behind railings and with porters' lodges at the main gates. The whole effect was designed to inspire confidence in the capabilities of medical science, as well as a measure of appropriate awe among the inhabitants of the district. It was the outward and visible sign of authoritarian benevolence and charity in an area that had for many decades experienced an intimate connection with deprivation and poverty, one in which successive waves of penniless immigrants settled alongside the original communities of London's poor, those who, in the definition of the great Victorian pioneer in social investigation, Henry Mayhew, will work, cannot work, and will not work.
Joseph Carey Merrick, born in Leicester on the 5th of August 1852, is better known as the Elephant Man. Through horrible physical deformities which are almost impossible to describe, he spent much of his life exhibited as a fairground freak until even 19th century sensibilities could take no more. Hounded, persecuted and starving, he ended up one day at Liverpool Street Station, where he was rescued, housed and fed by the distinguished surgeon, Frederick Treves. To Treves' surprise, he discovered during the course of their friendship that lurking beneath the mass of Merrick's corrupting flesh lived a spirit that was as courageous as it had been tortured and a nature as gentle and dignified as it had been deprived and tormented. An extraordinary and moving story set amongst the brutal realities of the Victorian world, telling of a tragic individual and his survival against overwhelming odds.
In such a district, therefore, Joseph Merrick arrived to fall under Tom Norman's care, it being hoped that the Elephant Man's impact on London would be profitable for them both. Outside the premises, across the shop front, leaving only the doorway clear, the showman hung a large canvas sheet, painted with a startling image of a man halfway through the process of turning into an elephant, and announcing that the same was to be seen within for the entrance price of tuppence. If the artistry was rough and the colours garish to sophisticated taste, the poster evidently had the sensational effect intended. A young surgeon from the London Hospital, Mr. Frederick Treves, who visited the freak show, could recall the poster in every vivid detail when he came to write about it some 40 years later. "This very crude production depicted a frightful creature that could only have been made possible in a nightmare. It was the figure of a man with the characteristics of an elephant. The transfiguration was not far advanced. There was still more of the man than of the beast. This fact, that it was still human, was the most repellent attribute of the creature. There was nothing about it of the pitiableness of the misshapen or the deformed, nothing of the grotesqueness of the freak, but merely the loathing insinuation of a man being changed into an animal. Some palm trees in the background of the picture suggested a jungle, and might have led the imaginative to assume that it was in this wild that the perverted object had roamed."
The True History of the Elephant Man by Michael Hull is read by Chris Courtney and runs for 9 hours and 33 minutes.
Revolution by Gary Newman was donated by Little Brown.
I wasn't born Gary Newman. I was born Gary Anthony James Webb in Hammersmith Hospital, London, 8th of March 1958, at 10:30 p.m. to be precise. The only child my mum would ever give birth to, although luckily not the only child she would ever be a mother to. My mum Beryl had worked as a dressmaker before falling pregnant with me, and she was still only 20 years old when I arrived. My dad, Anthony David Webb, although everyone knows him as Tony, was about a year and a half older than my mum, and by the time they got married, I was only a few months away from being born, a situation somewhat frowned upon back in those days. Dad was employed as a paint sprayer at the time, but had also worked as a merchant seaman and had spent 2 years in Germany doing his national service with the army. I have traits of both parents when it comes to the way I look, but my character seems to have come very much from my dad. Like him, I can be stubborn, argumentative, and opinionated, although we both mellowed a lot as we've got older. But, also like him, I am honest. Brutally honest, in fact.
Gary Numan has been lauded by everyone from Prince through the Foo Fighters and Nine Inch Nails to Lady Gaga. This book is Newman's long-awaited memoir, one that charts his two lives. The first, from growing up in West London, where he was expelled from school and beaten up daily for looking different, before discovering his first synthesizer and conquering the music world in rapid time, to the extravagance, the undiagnosed Asperger's, and the slow decline of a career that faded into near obscurity. The second, a 20-plus-year renaissance, catalysed by the date with a superfan, which had allowed Gary to rediscover his creativity, produce some of his best music, and become the true godfather of electropop. This is the story of one man, several dozen synthesizers, multiple issues, and two desperately different lives.
I found early on that running a band works best when you don't have to debate every decision. So, when it comes to my career, the buck stops with me. That works for creative projects as well. Too much input from other people just slows everything down and dilutes the finished result. I'm happy to come up with the ideas, make all the decisions, and sink or swim on what I end up with. It brings a lot of pressure, and it doesn't always work out well, but I'm not one to blame other people for my mistakes. So, not a perfectionist, but very much in charge of my own direction and future. My obsessive nature has been a powerful force with my music career, but it's also helped in many of the other things I've been involved in, flying aeroplanes being one. My mother came from a very close family, and as soon as she had a child of her own, she did everything she could to make sure we were safe and looked after. Although quite small in size, she could be a formidable woman. Fiery and protective, nothing came before family. If she took to you, though, she was warm and friendly, always ready to listen and to help. Around the time I was born, my parents were renting a room in a bungalow in Ashford, Middlesex, but not long after I came along, we were forced out by the landlady. Apparently, she accused my mum of washing the walls so much the paint had started to come off. Knowing my mum and her obsession with keeping a clean house, especially with a new baby, I suspect that may have been true. The next place we went to had a different kind of landlord problem. This one seemed to be more interested in looking at my mum than the walls, so we moved on again.
Revolution, Revolution by Gary Numan is read by the author and runs for 14 hours and 6 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Buddhist monk Gelong Tobten is one of the UK's most influential meditation teachers and a best-selling author. Renowned for his accessible, down-to-earth approach, he has brought the power of meditation into some of the most unexpected places, from hospitals and schools to prisons, boardrooms and beyond. He was at the Boswell Book Festival to talk about Handbook for Hard Times, A Monk's Guide to Fearless Living, and A Monk's Guide to Happiness, Meditation in the 21st Century. Both books are narrated by the author Gelong Tobten.
There is something in our attitude that doesn't add up. We strive to be happy, but are never sure how to get there. We don't seem to realize that a lot of our suffering comes from how we go about seeking its opposite. There is a certain amount of societal pressure at play here. We are constantly told we should be happy and that there's something wrong with us if we're not. But we remain unsure of what that happiness is. It feels elusive and depends on many unpredictable factors. We would all like to experience pleasant feelings, which we mistakenly think of as end products given to us by the events, objects, and people in the world around us. Consequently, we feel a sense of failure when we don't get what we want or encounter what we don't like. But do we ever really know what it is we are looking for? We long to possess the things we think will make us happy, only to discover that even after obtaining them, our desires have not been fulfilled. This means we never seem to achieve anything, as even when we do, we find ourselves still hoping for more or looking for something else. We feel perpetually unsatisfied, caught up in a continual chase. Ultimately, it is the search for happiness that makes us suffer. Searching leads to more searching, without any end. Additionally, in telling ourselves we want happiness, we are focusing on a lack of happiness and cultivating feelings of discontent with a need to keep hunting for what we think is missing.
I was talking about my book, Handbook for Hard Times, which has been out already now for a couple of years, but I'm still doing festivals and talks about it.
It's your second book. Your first book was A Guide to Happiness as yeah. well, which is available in audio read by yourself. How was that process?
It's a very interesting experience because when you record an audio book, you have to read the book out, but you have to also sort of not just sound like you're reading, you have to also make it sound fresh. And so I did actually find that quite challenging, but it's a nice process and quite interesting also to read your own words because you can't, while you're doing it, you start thinking of hundreds of edits you wish you'd made.
Yeah, I've heard many an author say who wrote this when they're reading that out.
Yes, who wrote this trash?
In pushing away discomfort, we usually don't see how the discomfort lies in the pushing. It is our habit of chasing pleasure and running away from hardship that is the real problem, as any habit simply proliferates. So we constantly chase more and push away more, reinforcing our sense of dissatisfaction. Meditation paves the way for changing those tendencies so that we can work with challenging situations and cultivate the crucial skills of gratitude, compassion, and forgiveness. This book is intended to help you progress far beyond the basics of your meditation practice, a handbook to support you in hard times, but also to serve as an ongoing resource for all times. The methods are not something only to dip into when you're feeling off-kilter, but are designed to be practiced regularly. If you can weave them into your life, they will make you more resilient and better able to handle whatever difficulties come your way.
So what actually got you started in writing?
Well, I contributed to a book by Ruby Wax. She wrote a book about meditation, and I was a contributor with a neuroscientist as well. It was a conversation between herself, a monk, me, myself, and a neuroscientist. And as a result of that book, a publisher got in touch with me and asked me to write my own books, and so the process started there.
If someone listening, I know radio is not the ideal method to do it, but if someone's listening, what sort of tips would you give for a bit of mindfulness and a bit of meditation?
Well, I would say it's very good to learn how to meditate and to do it every day, but I would also say it's important to practice tiny moments of meditation, even in busy situations. I mean, it's literally about just feeling the ground under your feet when you're standing in a queue or when you're sitting on a chair, being aware of the chair under your body. It's kind of these moments throughout the day where you can ground yourself in the present moment by being aware. And I think doing that as well as daily sessions of meditation is a very good combination.
Now your book is available in audio as read by yourself. It's available to people for whatever reason don't have a relationship with print, be it sight loss or dyslexia. Is that important to you?
Yeah, well, what's very important to me is that this kind of information and knowledge is available to everybody. So we need to make sure that there are different forms of presentation, written, audio, etc., so that everybody anybody can access helpful information. And one thing I did on the audiobook was I also recorded, because every chapter of my book ends with meditation exercises, so I recorded guided sessions where I'd give little moments of silence so people can do the practice and then there's more guidance. So then it becomes a practical tool, and that's very, very important.
Sit in a comfortable position in a relatively quiet place where you won't be disturbed. Bring your mind into connection with your body. Quite often, your body is here in the room, but not your mind, which is busy with distracting thoughts of the past or future. Here, you are teaching yourself to be fully present. Become aware of the contact between your body and the chair. Feel the chair under you and behind your spine. Spend a few moments exploring the sensations involved in sitting. Then, feel the ground under your feet. There's no need to take off your shoes. Next, pay attention to your hands, which are resting in your lap or on your legs. Notice the texture of your clothing and how that feels under your fingers and palms. Try not to think about it too much, but instead just experience the sensation of contact. Turn your attention to your shoulders and notice how any stress and tension fall away as you bring your focus to that area. Now you're going to move further inwards. Become aware of your mind and observe the flow of thoughts. Notice if you feel busy or groggy and sleepy. In either case, simply be aware, without trying to make your mind do anything, without even trying to meditate. Spend a few minutes just being with yourself in this way, and then end the session by relaxing in your chair with your mind at ease and without any sense of pressure or a need to achieve anything.
Handbook for Hard Times, A Monk's Guide to Fearless Living, and A Monk's Guide to Happiness, Meditation in the 21st Century, both by Geelong Thubten, are available wherever you buy your audiobooks. And we'll be getting an American no from Hollywood icon Rupert Everett after this.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy A Book for the Younger Listener or Young at Heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. For a time, the Talking Book Studios had a unique setup, one engineer to two readers.
Very odd, but we had, as we have now, extremely good narrators, and what we looked at is a way of increasing production and at the same time maintain quality. The engineer looked after two narrators at the same time, one reader reading one book, another reader reading another book. And the engineer used to jump from reader to reader, listen to what they were saying, making sure they're reading things correctly. The reader never knew who we were listening to, and so we could check on the quality of their reading and making sure that they were reading things properly. But it did mean that we were able to produce a lot of books from those studios.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123
9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hollywood actor and writer Rupert Everett has spent his life surrounded by extraordinary people and witnessed extraordinary events. He was in Moscow during the fall of communism, in Berlin the night the wall came down, and as we'll hear, in downtown Manhattan on 9/11. His memoir, Red Carpets and Other Banana Skins, sweeps from the lifestyle of the British upper classes to the madness of Hollywood. It's available abridged commercially, read by Rupert, and unabridged from RNIB Library, as read by Greg Wagland, and we'll hear from it later on. Rupert was at the Boswell Book Festival, though, to talk about his new book, The American No, which he narrates along with Alan Cordoner and Freddie Fox. It's a collection of stories taking us on an exhilarating journey with a cast of extraordinary characters.
I was sitting outside Bar Italia on Frith Street one afternoon last November. That ship of fools has been my home from home from home since I first moved to Soho in 1988. Sitting there, drifting, wrapped up against the drizzle like a pot in a tea cosy, was a singular experience verging on bliss. Surveying the street from this old bird's eye view, the straight Georgian lines of its brick flanks merging on Soho Square, was like looking at a negative or a double exposure, because the black faces of ghosts seemed to stare through the walls, memories hidden in doorways lit suddenly by the long-forgotten flare of a match. With a wink of the mind's eye, the focus was pulled to the distant past, while the present moment bent and blurred in the patter of rain. In the old days, I had breakfast every day at Bar Italia, lunched next door at Little Italy, conducted my business meetings, my promotional endeavours, and my love affairs on the strip of pavement between the two establishments. Most of my friends lived within walking distance: Alan, Julia, Bailey, and John. Occasionally, I acted in a play and tottered back and forth to the theatre. I rarely left Soho, perhaps to meet the old Chelsea crowd from before the war, but I always ran back as soon as I could. Once you had lived in that strange corner, nothing else would ever do.
Rupert Everett reading from his book The American No. At the Boswell Book Festival, I asked him, what is an American No?
An American No in show business is when you go for a meeting to pitch an idea to a studio or a group of executives, and the meeting goes incredibly well, and everyone says they love you and they want to work with you. They can't wait for it all to begin, and you leave the meeting walking on air, you buy a new car, you redecorate your house, and then you never hear from any of them ever again. And that's called The American No.
So your book is a collection of stories that, were they rejected or were they things that you pitched before?
One of them only ever got made. Most of them were just rejected.
On an ordinary evening, I would leave my room at the hotel, ring the bell of Alan's flat, collect him, pass by Princess Julia's, and then go on to Bailey and John's on Charing Cross Road. But this was all 30 years ago now, all gone, like tears in the rain. Alan killed himself, Julia moved east, John lives in Italy. Only Bailey remains. Apart from him, Soho is another country. Briefly, we queens achieved supremacy, but we were moved on with the hookers and the homeless at around the time of Paul Raymond's death. I too had some kind of ascendancy. Traffic stopped when I crossed Old Compton Street. Well, not exactly, but you know what I mean. Today, I'm just another old oddity, with scowling lips haunting the streets, walked through, another ghost as I cross the road at Cambridge Circus. Occasionally, some medium from the old days sees one and screams. Sometimes greetings are exchanged, sometimes not. Often things are better left behind. The only group to survive, rain or shine, it seems, are the Hare Krishnas, and here they come now in the headlights and the spitting rain, turning the corner out of Soho Square, quite a big group today, clashing their cymbals and singing their songs, transcendental Morris dancers weaving around to the beat of their little drum, fully made up, pink and apricot, saris and dhotis, sandals and trainers. Some have backpacks crammed with their day drag. I used to find them annoying, but today, looming through the gathering dusk, they're enchanting, strange, a caravan of wonderful freaks crossing the asphalt desert. They arrived from a fairy kingdom with their cymbals, their drums. Someone had a portable sound system and his voice rang out, amplified, and bounced across the street, urging the others on. "Hare, hare," they sang back. Unlike myself, they still stopped traffic. People still looked out of windows or stood and gaped.
Now, the audio version of the book is narrated by yourself and two other narrators. Were you involved in the casting of the other people?
I was. I didn't read it all myself because it's a very, very difficult thing to do, to read a whole book. And I liked very much these two actors, Freddie Fox and Alan Corduna, who read the other parts. And so it seemed like a good idea.
Now, I was here a couple of years ago with Lady Anne Glenconner, and she told me you tried to talk her out of narrating her own book.
Oh, did I? But did she narrate her own book?
She did in the end, yeah.
Well, and she probably enjoyed it too, because she's loved everything to do with her book. I just find it, you need, it's not as easy as it seems, just sitting in a room talking to the microphone. Mm. It's definitely an art, but one she probably has. I never listened to her audio because I read the book.
That's what I was going to ask. Sort of, you're used to acting on screen and stage. Is it hard to pour that performance into the microphone?
No, it's not that. It's that you're sitting there with the page and it just seems endless. And after a certain moment, you kind of lose the will to live, if you're me. And then you kind of get depressed and you think, oh, this is so bad. And then you kind of spiral. That's what I find. And you do definitely need a kind of performance intensity and energy to get you through. And it's difficult, isn't it? None of these things are that easy.
Now your book is available in audio. It's accessible to anyone for whatever reason. Dyslexia, sight loss, doesn't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Very important, because it means it opens it up to people who are visually impaired. It opens it up to people who go on long journeys in cars. Lots of great things happen. It's difficult because it's not the same, and normally you don't get to hear the whole of someone's book. It's edited. And that's another reason why it's horrible doing your own audio, because you read it and you think, why did they edit this bit? And that was my best bit. And that can be difficult too. No, I think it's great doing audios.
As I mentioned earlier, Rupert's memoir, Red Carpets and Other Banana Skins, is available from RNIB unabridged, as read by Greg Wagland.
Look at the World Trade Center. Looking up is one of the great sensations in New York. There is mayhem all around you, but up there is silence and space, and the tips of the high towers commune with the heavens like eyelashes brushing against a lover's cheek. And in that glance from the street to the skyscraper lies the whole American dream. There was a hole in the North Tower, like a tear. Were they making a movie? Then there was a bang like Concorde breaking the speed of sound. You felt it slightly in your body and your ears popped. The second plane crashed into the South Tower, and we watched in speechless wonder as glass and metal began to fall from the towers in glittering shards that caught the sun. They were like two fireworks about to go off. People stood in the streets looking up. Cars stopped and passengers got out. Some people still scurried about their day until somebody nudged them, and they too looked up and froze. I never saw so many vacant faces.
I'm just going to address a strange coincidence, because I interviewed Martin Jarvis here a few years ago, mm-hmm. who happened to be in Manhattan during 9/11, mm-hmm. as were you, mm-hmm. as documented in your book.
Yeah, 9/11 was an amazing event to have witnessed. I was in my house as the first plane happened, and I was trying to do some Buddhist chants, and I was chanting, and all these ambulances kept going, and I went, and I had to stop my meditation, but it was because they were all going down to the World Trade Center.
The wailing was for later. For now, it was like the end of the world in a movie, when the spaceships hover over Manhattan. Hollywood had out-tricked us. And at first it wasn't possible to take it all in. Everything one saw that day was lifted from a movie, every cop, every scream, every plummeting body. And of course the ultimate special effect, the two towers consuming themselves and crashing to the ground. We'd seen it all before in countless movies, and movies were all we had left in that September of 2001. They were real. Actual life was swept under the carpet and ignored. One half expected to see Bruce Willis appearing out of the rubble, holding the movie's unconscious babe in his arms. Then someone would shout, "Cut!" and we could move on.
And how have you found Dumfries House and Boswell so far?
Very exciting. The trees outside were, first of all, incredible. And I just had a little look around the house. It's beautiful, incredible. And it's one of the, I mean, how spoiled is one to be able to come up here and see this place, stay in the nice hotel? It's gorgeous.
It was only later, when that hard, angry city turned for once into a fountain of compassion, that one was foolish enough to believe that the day's events could be the kernel for a quantum leap towards world peace. Anyone would help you that day, absolutely anyone. It wasn't just a disco song, a Motown myth. Love was finally in the air. Maybe we could stop in its name. But the powers that be wanted to go on with the movie version, and the rest is history.
Rupert Everett's book Red Carpets and Other Banana Skins and Vanished Years are available from RNIB Library in audio, and The American Novel is available in print as an e-book and in audio commercially.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally on today's show, a return to Helen Lederer for the books of her life.
Was there a book from your childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
I did like Enid Blyton, I have to confess, because it was naughty and fun. And Noel Stutfield, Tennis Shoes, Dancing Shoes, again, very exciting narrative, naughtiness and success all at once.
The Heaths lived at Tulse Hill. Their father was a doctor. He had not meant to be a doctor. He would have liked to have been a soldier, but in an accident, he was shot through the leg. Unfortunately, his leg was very badly hurt, and he walked lame ever afterwards. Obviously, soldiers have to have both their legs working properly, so he became a doctor instead. He was not the rich sort of doctor people go to see in Harley Street, paying 5 guineas a visit, but the sort that looks after large families. Dr. Heath quite understood about large families, having 4 children of his own. Mrs. Heath was just the right sort of wife for a doctor. She always remembered what had been the matter with the patients and asked after them when she met them outside, and sent round flowers and lent books when they were ill, and sometimes, when they were convalescent and had no garden, suggested they would get well quicker if they came and sat in hers. She had been very pretty when Dr. Heath married her, but being busy and running in and out in all weathers had made her skin rather rough, and anxious times over money had turned some of her hair grey. It did not matter about these things, because neither Dr. Heath nor the children would have anything about her different. They all thought her perfect as she was. The 4 Heath children were called Jim, Susan, Nicolette, and David. Jim and Susan were twins. All the children had different shades of red hair. They got this from their father and their grandfather, who were red-headed. Grandfather was not red anymore, except in one little patch in his left eyebrow. Jim's hair was really only just red. Many people would have called it sandy. Susan was the beauty of the family. Her hair was the lovely shade of red. It was long and it curled. At parties and things like that, It was combed out and worn loose, and people admired it, which she hated because she was shy. Ordinary days she wore it in two plaits. She was rather tall for her age and thin, and had reddish brown eyes and a pink and white complexion.
Tennis Shoes by Noel Stretfield is available commercially and from RNIB Talking Books as narrated by her nephew, Bill Stretfield.
Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
I did enjoy John Fowle's The Magus because that was kind of early fantasy, quite erotic narrative. And who doesn't like that?
I was born in 1927, the only child of middle-class parents, both English, and themselves born in the grotesquely elongated shadow, which they never rose sufficiently above history to leave, of that monstrous dwarf, Queen Victoria. I was sent to a public school. I wasted 2 years doing my national service. I went to Oxford. And there I began to discover I was not the person I wanted to be. I had long before made the discovery that I lacked the parents and ancestors I needed. My father was, through being the right age at the right time, rather than through any great professional talent, a brigadier. And my mother was the very model of a would-be Major General's wife. That is, she never argued with him, and always behaved as if he were listening in the next room, even when he was thousands of miles away. I saw very little of my father during the war, and in his long absences I used to build up a more or less immaculate conception of him, which he generally, a bad but appropriate pun, shattered within the first 48 hours of his leave. Like all men, not really up to their job, he was a stickler for externals and petty quotidian things, and in lieu of an intellect, he had accumulated an armoury of capitalised keywords like discipline and tradition and responsibility. If I ever dared, I seldom did, to argue with him, he would produce one of these totem words and cosh me with it, as no doubt in similar circumstances he quelled his subalterns. If one still refused to lie down and die, he lost, or loosed, his temper. His temper was like a red dog, and he always had it close to hand. The wishful tradition is that our family came over from France after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. Noble Huguenots, remotely allied to Honoré d'Urfey, author of the 17th century bestseller L'Astrée. Certainly, if one excludes another equally unsubstantiated link with Tom Durfee, Charles II's scribbling friend, no other of my ancestors showed any artistic leanings whatever. Generation after generation of captains, clergymen, sailors, squirelings, with only a uniform lack of distinction and a marked penchant for gambling and losing to characterise them. My grandfather had 4 sons, 2 of whom died in the First World War. The third took an unsavoury way of paying off his atavism, gambling debts, and disappeared to America. He was never referred to as still existing by my father, a youngest brother who had all the characteristics that eldest sons are supposed to possess, and I have not the least idea whether he is still alive, or even whether I have unknown cousins on the other side of the Atlantic.
The Magus by John Fowles is available in audio from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Ian Craig.
And is there something you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend?
I would recommend Yellowtail, which is a book I spoke about for BBC Radio, and it is a thriller about the writing industry. I cannot remember the author's name, but Yellowtail is a page-turner.
I'll edit that in right now.
I think Helen was referring to Yellow Face by R.F. Kuang.
It's a running joke that every serious author at some point does a grand and ambitious war novel, and I suppose this one is Athena's. She has the confidence, the understated and lyrical prose necessary to tell such a heavy story without coming across as pompous, juvenile, or sanctimonious. Most grand war epics by young writers tend to read like mere imitations of grand war epics. Their authors come off as toddlers riding toy horses. But Athena's war epic sounds like an echo from the battlefield. It rings true. It's clear what she meant when she called this an evolution in her craft. So far, her novels had presented linear narratives, all told in the past tense from the third-person perspective of a singular protagonist. But here, Athena does something similar to what Christopher Nolan does in the movie Dunkirk. Instead of following one particular story, she layers disparate narratives and perspectives together to form a moving mosaic, a crowd crying out in unison. It's cinematic in effect. You can almost see it in your head, documentary style, a multiplicity of voices unburying the past. A story with no proper protagonist shouldn't be this compelling, but Athena's sentences are so engaging. I keep getting lost in the story, reading ahead instead of transcribing it to my laptop. It's a love story disguised as a war story, and the details are so shockingly vivid, so particular. It's hard to believe it's not a memoir, that she didn't simply transcribe the words of ghosts speaking in her ear. I understand now why this took so very long to write. The painstaking research bleeds through in every paragraph, from the standard-issue fur-lined hats to the enamel mugs the laborers used to drink their watered-down tea. She has this sorcerous ability to keep your eyes riveted to the page. I have to know what happens to A. Geng, the spindly student translator, and Xiao Li, the unwanted seventh son. I'm in tears at the end when I find out that Liu Dong never made it back home to his waiting bride. But it needs work. It's far from a first draft. It's not even a proper draft, really. It's more like an amalgamation of startlingly beautiful sentences, bluntly stated themes, and the occasional, and then they travel complete later.
Yellow Face by R.F. Kuang is available commercially and from RNIB Talking Books as narrated by Helen Laser. That's all we've got time for in today's edition of Read On, but there's plenty more to come from the Boswell Book Festival in the next few weeks. If you can't wait that long, you can download previous editions of the show as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. You can email the show using radio@rnib.org.uk or find me on X at @talking_books.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.